Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
As she came back into the bedroom, I passed him across to her, and as soon as he rested in her arms, he took his last breath. And it was unquestionable in my mind that he waited for her to die.
In the months and years following a loss, the experience of a bereavement often affords a person a new outlook or approach to life. This week's guest, Justin Caffrey, experienced this firsthand after the premature birth of his baby son, Joshua, just 25 weeks into pregnancy. And that, of course, changed his family's life forever. Justin, first of all, thank you very much for joining us today. Your baby's death, Joshua, can you bring us back to the beginning?
Sure. And thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. So yes, Joshua's death was certainly unexpected, which of course I think is always the case for any of us when we lose somebody. But we happened to be on a family holiday. My wife was 6 months pregnant, and Joshua was to be our second child. We'd already gone through 3 miscarriages leading up to the pregnancy with Joshua, and we actually had, just before we found out she was pregnant for the fourth time, we'd actually ruled out the whole idea of even trying again, because we started to feel that the stress was too much on my wife, and the pressure, and you know, it was impacting her health as well. And then miraculously he came along. So we went to Spain just for a week to take a little holiday before the second child. And whilst we were in Spain, I think maybe 3 days into our vacation, Beatrice woke me up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning to tell me that our waters had broken. And we were at this stage about 260 or 280 kilometers from the nearest hospital, which we only found after a few hours where it was, because we didn't know where anything was at that stage. We're on vacation, so you don't really think about these kind of things. And it was funny because it followed the night before, where we'd actually sat down and had a conversation about, you know, how great everything is in our life at that moment. So it also taught us a lesson to not be too complacent, because everything can change in a moment, as we discovered that day. So we had a mad dash to try and find a hospital, which we did, and we got to a maternity hospital in Malaga, and they checked Beatrice and said that they thought it was possible they could prolong the pregnancy, which was critical, because she was 25 weeks pregnant at that stage. But they said, you know, we weren't going anywhere, we couldn't fly anywhere, we couldn't travel, we needed to stay exactly where we were, and we'd have to stay in the hospital, and she'd have to stay in the hospital. So we had a 3-year-old with us, and we obviously had a life that was still going on back in the UK. We lived in, lived in England at that stage, so we were stuck, and that's how life stopped really for us at that moment. And then Joshua lived for 11 months, but it was within the turmoil of everything that happened from that point on, really.
First of all, I can't even begin to fathom being in that situation when you have no support, you have no family members around, you have no friends around, you have no one to help look after your older child. It must have been so isolating. How did you guys as a family kind of, you must have just had to come together and live in the moment and support each other as a little unit. Is that kind of how it happened for you guys?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that really is it. You know, you I think human beings have an incredible capacity to deal with a crisis. You know, people will always look or listen to my story and think, I don't know how it would cope with it. But I think you don't have a lot of options, you know, especially when you're dealing with another child who is three.
And they've no idea what's going on.
No idea. So, you know, for him, this is kind of like, what? Where is the world gone?
Yeah, where's the swimming pool? Where's the beach?
Absolutely. So we just had to try and find a capacity to deal with it. And I always remember after we'd gotten Beatrice into hospital and then we were there for the whole day and doctors had seen her, etc. And then I had to try and find somewhere to stay that night with my son in Malaga. And of course, I had no idea anything about the city or anything else. Mm. And eventually found this hotel. And I remember trying to check into a hotel at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night with a three-year-old sitting on the counter crying because he is really upset and confused. I'm having to have an argument with the people in the hotel who are telling me that I don't have a reservation and I can't check in. And that was like, I thought, oh, this is just, you know, the absolute pits. In reality, that was the first time of extreme tension. And we never made it out of Spain for another 11 months. So, you know.
Can I ask you about that extreme tension? Because I think a lot of people who go through grief and loss, a lot of times there's years and months or weeks leading up to the loss of the person they love that are exceptionally stressful. And it sounds like your circumstances, that was the case. Obviously, you had some time to maybe get used to your, God, I hate to say it, new normal, but, you know, you got used to the world you were living in. But I don't know, for you, did you feel, you know, the book Body Keeps Score, like that this kind of level of stress or trauma stays with you? Do you feel like, that's a hard question to ask, I'm not really sure how to phrase it, but that kind of stress that you probably, I don't know if you had experienced previously in your life where you're trying to get your family together and figure out things on the spot, and it's such high stakes because it's the people you love. Has that stayed with you in your mind and body? Has that been something you've had to work on?
Yeah, I mean, definitely something that I had to work on. I think I was lucky in a weird way that I was used to high levels of stress. You know, I've been running quite large businesses for myself in the UK for many years, since I was very young. So I've been dealing with high levels of stress since I was 19. And sadly, I also went through the process of losing my nephew to meningitis back in 2001. And that had a very traumatic impact on me too. And it created this immense fear in me that I would lose a child. And now I was, you know, in that moment, the thing that I feared was now sitting, you know, right in front of me. So that was very jarring emotionally. But in the times that followed, and especially after Joshua's death, where I went on to struggle with post-traumatic stress, you know, reliving that period was important, and seeing that stress and also being able to forgive yourself, because we kind of beat ourselves up for how we behave around extreme situations like bereavement, like, why didn't I do this or say this or whatever. But, you know, you're being a human being in the moment and you're trying your best. So in hindsight, I think there's a huge amount of forgiveness around bereavement for our own perceived behaviors. You know, I blame myself for Joshua's death in the years that followed, and it was nonsensical, but that's quite a normal reaction
to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's important for people to realize that. But I think a lot of people with bereavement issues hold on to that because they're embarrassed to speak about it, because they think, well, if I speak about it, then maybe I am guilty. Maybe it is my fault. But it's important for people to realize that it's just a natural way of behaving. And the more we try and then hide or push away from that, the more it kind of is shaking like a volcano ready to erupt.
Can I ask you about your older son? Because you're on holidays, which is supposed to be a happy time for families. And then all this changed and you were there for 11 months. How did you explain what was happening to him, or how did he adjust? How did you help him deal with what was going on?
Just in the most honest and open way that we could. You know, it's funny, life gives you experiences that you can either ignore or learn from. And when I was a kid, my father suffered really badly with clinical depression and anxiety, and was hospitalized on multiple occasions in a mental institute. And my mother didn't even tell me where he was, and my family didn't want to tell everybody else where he was. So, you know, I remember being that child, desperately confused and trying to orientate myself in the world. So when we get into that situation, it was just, look, we just got to tell it as it is. And you know, he was three when we arrived. This was January, and he turned four at the end of April. So, you know, we were just honest about the fact that, you know, his brother was born. He shouldn't have been born yet. He's not very well. We also had to have the difficult conversations to say that it really is down to the doctors as to whether or not they will be able to make him better. Mm. But every day that he's alive, we can be thankful that he's here. So, I mean, for years afterwards, Luca always thought that every child is born, they spend months in hospital. So his perception, of course, was different. But Joshua was in two different hospitals. He just referred to them as the doctor's house. So he always just said, oh yeah, baby Joshua's in the doctor's house. And he could never see Joshua when he was in neonatal intensive care. So the first time he got to meet Joshua was 5 months after he was born. Mm-hmm. And it's a hugely impactful thing on Luca's life. You know, we couldn't have any more children after Joshua. And he is very emotionally connected to loss. And now as a 13-year-old kid, he's very sensitive in the context of understanding his emotions. You know, Joshua's ashes are in the house. Here we have photographs of them all around the house. So we're all deeply connected to him and speak about him, and that helps him, I think.
That's so wonderful. I think that you intuitively knew, like, so that you got, like, kind of let yourself guide that and know that that was the right thing. I recently spoke to a therapist, not in a professional setting, just a casual conversation at the playground. And she was telling me that a lot of times with children that she works with, when they start talking to the kids, they realize that the problem is that the parents didn't tell them about something that had happened that was significant in their family. So I think the openness, although it's a lot, it takes a lot of bravery to be that open and to kind of maybe trust that they'll be able to handle it in some way. It obviously stands to them maybe long term. 11 months is a short and a long time, but you would have gotten to know Joshua. Can you tell us about who he was? What was he like?
I think just to finish one point on the impact on my other son, I think it's important as well for children who are going through bereavement issues, whether it's you know, one of their own parents or siblings or close family. What we've done in the years subsequent is Luca has been with a therapist, I think, three times over the last 10 years. So we just do a check-in, and there's some fantastic child therapists where they'll just, you know, see how he is and then talk to us. So, you know, I think it's an important thing to realize that often for adults, we can go through therapy. Children, their brain is evolving so much, it's worth checking in. So he's been great. So Joshua was, he was born weighing 900 grams. You know, he was so unbelievably tiny. It was funny. I found some video of him the other day in an incubator, which I'm gonna post it on my social media, because there's so many photographs of him. But actually, us interacting with him and just, you know, holding his hand, and you just see this tiny little body, and the skin is just so fragile on the bones. He arrived after Beatrice started bleeding day four in the hospital, and there was then an emergency cesarean section. He had hypoxic brain injury during that cesarean. So there was mistakes made in the Malaga hospital, which caused problems in the context of his struggle to breathe. And then when they did remove him during the cesarean, they gave him 24 hours to live, because they said, you know, they think it was too traumatic. And then he lived 48 hours, and then he lived 3 days, and then he lived a week, and then they started to talk to us about, you know, maybe there is a pathway here to recovery. So he was in the incubator for 5 months, and to be born at 28 weeks is touch and go. Nowadays, technology is better because they cool the brain. They didn't do that in Malaga at the time. So we did a lot of kangaroo care, where you take the baby and you put him on your chest. And the way we operated for the next 5 months was one of us would be with Luca and one of us would be with Joshua, and we'd take turns. So a lot of being with him, a lot of singing to him, a lot of having skin contact when we could. You know, neonatal intensive care for 5 months can be a hugely traumatic and debilitating thing for a child, even if they recover from everything else.
Mm-hmm.
He struggled. He had a collapsed lung during that time. He had to have a complete blood transfusion at one stage. He had pneumonia. He had bronchitis. And he was intubated 3 times during 5 months. And the intubation of a small baby is a very unpleasant thing to see. And whatever progress they have made until the point they're intubated, everything is then just gone and you're back to zero again. So we knew he had quite likely was going to have cerebral palsy, but we were making little improvements and then it would go back. So he couldn't eat properly. He was tube fed. He was obviously fully oxygen dependent and moving between, you know, a CPAP where it's positive oxygen being pushed in, or where they would have to then intubate him where it's onto full life support. So those 5 months were pretty extreme. And then after that, he started to recover a bit, and that's when we were then trained to be his carers for a while.
You're in a foreign country. Were there language barriers? There must have been times when it was extremely frustrating for all of you.
Yeah. I mean, language barriers were extraordinary. You know, this was Malaga in 2010. Spain, unlike a lot of other European countries, didn't have a huge amount of English speaking within schools in the kind of 80s and 90s. So the physicians that we were dealing with who were, you know, in their 30s in 2010, most of them didn't speak English at all. We were very lucky that there was a Canadian nurse who was in the hospital. But, you know, we would just have sporadic days where we would find her. They didn't have any protocols to help, you know, English parents who accidentally gave birth to a child in Spain. It wasn't something that they really had to deal with. So language was extremely difficult. My wife, who's German and fluent in English and French, she really focused on her Spanish. We got some really good Spanish teachers. My Spanish was appalling, but her Spanish improved so much. I mean, so much to the point that, you know, by month 8 and 9, she was sitting having conversations with the neurology team about,
wow,
you know, the outs of his brain injury. Whereas I could probably at best order them a coffee with milk. But she was phenomenal. And that really did save our bacon. But it was, even for her though, if she was sitting here now, when she would talk about being in her most fluent in Spanish, it was still really hard because...
But it's terminology and everything as well.
Yeah.
In terms of like a place can have such a huge, anytime, you know, where the place you lost the person, the place the trauma took, you know, where it happened, even just thinking about it. I have that a lot with, I think a lot about like the turns on certain roads, and it's a strange thing. But have you been, like, what's your relationship with Malaga now? Have you ever been back? You know, is there a desire to be there, or the opposite? Do you never want to be there?
No, my relationship is really, really positive. So we've been back several times. We actually ended up buying a house not too far away from Malaga. We came very close to Spain during those 11 months. And, you know, we always thought Joshua was going to get out of Spain. So we thought he was coming back with us. He just never made it. So we felt very close to it. And in our time in Malaga, we lived in 5 houses. The last house that we lived in was the house that he actually died in, because we were eventually able to take him into our care so he could die in a non-medicated environment. So he died in this house. And I remember we went back to that house maybe 5 years ago. And I always had this sense of wanting to go back to the house. And you know, obviously we didn't go into the house, but we drove up to the house and we sat in the car, and I just close my eyes and I just wanted to kind of feel a connection to his spirit. And I just wanted to say, you know, like, we're here, whatever is left within you that was here at this house, I just wanted to feel that connection and just get this sense of kind of bringing the last bits of him back with us to Ireland. So that was a really beautiful moment. And then we went into the hospital and we had lunch in the hospital, like in this horrible canteen that was our home for you know, months.
Mm-hmm.
Went back and we sat in there and we smiled and just thought about, you know, the good times. So I think in many ways it's that fear of going back to these things, but when you go inside them, they're not as bad as you remember them to be. And I think that journey was an important one for us at the time to get more comfortable with the whole situation.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I remember sending my friend a picture. I had gone back to the canteen and I sent a picture and she said, "Why are you there?" She was horrified that I would go back there. She couldn't understand it at all. But I just sat, just like you said, I sat down and I had some lunch and I had a coffee and I felt quite, there was a sense of comfort in the sense, like I was connected to that place. Which is, you know, so it's interesting to hear that people kind of relate to it very, you know, very differently in terms of the place. When I was reading your story, Justin, I have to say, when you talked about losing Joshua the night that you lost him, as a parent, I had to actually keep coming back to read it. I couldn't read it in one sitting because it was just a very, very, very beautiful way that you talked about the moment and how you guys, can you talk a little bit about as a parent what that is like and how, I don't know, I guess it's hard to ask the question, but
don't worry, I get it. I think up until Christmas of that year in Spain, we'd started to plan to come back to Ireland. So although we lived in England, we realized that we needed support because we knew that, like, irrespective of Joshua's outcome, he was going to need help and support for most of his life. And we'd been in contact with Jonathan Irwin at Jack and Jill, who I happen to know, and I'd supported Jonathan on a couple of things before. And it was really weird to phone up Jonathan and tell him, you know, I now have a Jack and I need your help. So we'd started the preparation work and we'd already started to work the air ambulance because it was only at this point in 11 months where they felt he could be lifted and could endure that kind of journey back in a plane on an air ambulance. And then it all went wrong. So it was Christmas Day. Christmas Eve. We couldn't sustain him at home. So we trained us as carers and they said, provided we lived within 2 kilometers of the hospital, we could work with him at home. So he was still tube fed, oxygen dependent. We had to vacuum out his lungs and his breathing systems every day, multiple times, but we could be together as a family and the doctors would call every second day, and they'd always be available if needed. And the whole thing was then to try and start rehabilitation for him. But many times during having him home in our care, he would relapse. We couldn't sustain him with oxygen at home. We'd have to bring him back to the hospital. And this particular Christmas Eve issue, we brought him there. It was late into the evening. We got to hospital. They immediately said that they needed to intubate him again, so put him back on full life support, which was really hard to hear because we'd been working really hard in rehab. And once they do that, they pump him full of drugs. You know, literally, it's like watching a baby being blown up like a balloon with the amount of medication they put in. And they said, look, there's nothing you can do now. You know, he's out cold. You guys need to just go home now, get some rest. It was late. So we drove home, and the next morning was Christmas morning. So we got up, and we have some beautiful video of organizing a really nice Christmas morning for Luca. We did the footprints of Santa and all those kind of things. And we said, look, whatever happens from this point, we want to keep Christmas Day sacred. And then we got a call in the afternoon to come to the hospital. They said, you need to come now. It's really important. So we came. And by the time we got there, which was kind of 20 minutes, half an hour later, they said, oh, he turned a corner. They thought he was going to die and they couldn't hold him. But now they've got him back. But they said to us that, look, you know, if your normal medical team had been here, because it's not Christmas, then they wouldn't have intubated anymore. And they said, look, we know your story. We know about you guys being stuck here, but it's now time to let go. And as a hospital, we can't do this anymore. So, you know, now you need to plan for palliative care. So we had to fight one last big fight, a legal battle to have him released into our care to die at home. We didn't want him to die in hospital. And we needed to be able to apply morphine to him because he was eventually going to die of asphyxiation because it was his breathing that was a problem. So we needed him to die pain-free and peacefully. So bringing him home and having him at home was really nice. And we had 3 weeks together. And in the night before his death, he had multiple cardiac arrests. And we kept thinking he's going to die. This is it, and he'd come back to life again. And I mean, that was just a bizarre experience because you're upset, and then you're kind of slightly elated, but you know at the end is coming. But we got to take him into bed with us that last night after he'd recovered from multiple heart attacks, and he slept in between us, and we had a beautiful night and morning together. And then the next day we knew that we needed Luca to be taken outside because we knew Joshua was going to die and we didn't want him to witness that finality, not at 4 years of age. My parents had come over from Ireland, so they took Luca down to the beach and I had Joshua in the bedroom and Beatrice had been organizing Luca. And then as she came back into the bedroom, I passed him across to her, and as soon as he rested in her arms, he took his last breath. And it's always really nice for us because it was unquestionable in my mind that he waited for her to die. And it was a very peaceful end to a very traumatic year. And then, you know, what happened then afterwards was I saw Beatrice just move into this primal state where she started to prepare his body. And he always had tape on his face because he had oxygen masks and tubes going in to feed him. So she just started to clean his body and clean him down. And I know this is a very strange thing to say, but it was just the most natural experience you could possibly have. And I think we don't have that experience because people die away from us in homes or hospitals or these kind of places. But there's a primal instinct within us when it comes to death that we often try and run away from.
Do you think that, like you were saying, as her mom, that women, like the birth part of it and then the death part of it, that like there's some part of you that knows what to do? I mean, I think that's what you're saying. Like, you know, like the way that having a baby, like she knew what to do, even though she had no like reason to know, but she did.
To this day, I don't think I'll see anything more incredible until the day that I die, because I didn't have that intuition, that sense of what to do next. And so I had to go and let my parents know and find Luca. And then I also had to organize funeral home to come. So I was out of the house for 20 minutes, half an hour. And then I came back to the house again. And she had this aura about her and this way of being that was just primal. And I said, primal always sounds like kind of like scary or aggressive. I mean, in this beautiful, serene way of being with that child. And I think it's definitely, it was a maternal instinct. And just like, of course, you know, if there's no doctors around, women still give birth. And I think we've over-medicated our view on many things. And yeah, it was a beautiful end to Joshua's life. And he died very peacefully. And it was a really nice experience for us. It was obviously horrendous to lose your son. But you also then come to terms, which everybody unfortunately has to when it comes to terminal illness, that their life that they're living is no longer sustainable. So you have to kind of let go. As parents, you want to strive and do whatever you can to keep them alive. But eventually, you have to let go.
Yeah, it's a hard decision.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we tortured over the whole idea for days. We don't have any alternative. I mean, we know from speaking to friends of ours in the UK who are physicians that the NHS would not have intubated and brought Joshua back to life as many times as the Spanish medical system did. So it's country dependent. So we got 11 months because we were there. I mean, somebody once said to me that it would be highly unlikely if they would have even resuscitated him after he was born in a UK facility because he was such challenged in the context of a brain injury and hypoxia and everything else. So you learn to be grateful about so many things. And it's the only way to truly appreciate that loss is to find gratitude.
Yeah. So while it wasn't ideal being in Spain by any stretch of the imagination, maybe it was meant to be because you got that extra time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you know, he was Joshua Raphael Caffrey. So we gave him a Spanish name. I mean, you know, it felt right.
I was going to say death can change a person, but I'm going to change that. It just does. I don't think there's any situation where it doesn't. I think grief, it changes forever. And oftentimes, this is a really difficult sensitive area to talk about, but oftentimes there are things that change you for the better, and there are things that you evolve onto another plane a little bit. You're kind of in a different space in your mind and your heart and your empathy. You evolve into a whole other person in a lot of ways, and you learn a lot about humanity and about yourself and about relationships. I know that's something that's happened for you, where you've taken the experience and it has changed you forever. Can you talk a little bit about that? It's a hard one because I know for so many people, they, especially in the early stages, can only see it as this thing that will be a terrible, terrible change for them that will have no element of evolution to it. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I think grief, I always think, consumes you, right? But once you're being consumed, it's very difficult to see that there's going to be any light at the end of this tunnel. And I, you know, when we talk about the death of a child, you know, first of all, it's a taboo subject especially in older generations to even talk about the whole idea of the death of a child. But I think it's an important thing to discuss because it shows that everything is recoverable. Like, no matter how horrendous it is, we can still get past it. We can still move on with our lives, albeit, you know, we're different. And as you rightly say, everybody changes on the back of it. After Joshua died, we decided to still come and live in Ireland because we thought, well, you know, let's not just go back to our normal life in the UK and the rat race, which, you know, no offense to people from the UK and a lot of my friends and clients are still there, but it's a different lifestyle compared to living in Ireland. So we still had Luca now, who was, you know, 4 going on 5. And we thought it would be good to take some time, have some family support, and to be in Ireland. And I had lived away from Ireland since I was 19. So I hadn't really been around my family that much. So I was kind of looking forward to that as well. So we came back and Beatrice spent, you know, many months after we arrived back walking in the mountains in Wicklow where we lived, with a golden retriever dog that we got at that stage, Sanchez, keeping the Spanish team, and he's still with us now. And she really came to terms with so much about herself in that whole period of time. I decided to set up a new business in a different country with clients all over the world and live on an airplane for the next 2 years. And, you know, I was taking like 150, 170 flights a year, never really connecting into my grief, never really going into the dark recesses of my mind that I needed to sit with. And it was on those flights that I would always have 5 minutes at the start of the flight and 5 minutes at the end, where you're not allowed to put your headphones on, you're not allowed to do anything except just wait while you take off and land. And they were the moments when I would have flashbacks about the trauma and when I would feel my chest, and I kept ignoring it and putting it away. And it, you know, it slowly moved into the point that I knew I needed to have a drink on a plane as soon as I could, because after takeoff, I knew that was going to be coming into my mind. So I spent 3 years kind of pushing it away, suppressing it, and building a business, which eventually ended up in a panic attack. And I thought I was having a heart attack or a stroke. I had no idea what was going on. I mean, it's so incredible how far removed we can come from grief that we don't even notice. Of course, this is why I'm not feeling well, because my son died 2.5 years ago, like, and I've never dealt with it, but I didn't see it that way. And that was the real wake up call when I realized that I needed to get some help. But, you know, another couple of weeks passed from there. And then I started to be drawn into suicidal ideation, where I really felt like I wanted to end my own life. And I couldn't really articulate why. But it wasn't Joshua's death that was really the biggest problem for me. I think grief in an extreme can often be the straw that breaks the camel's back. You know, many times we all have stresses and traumas and everything else that we're carrying with us through life. And then there's a massive moment in grief and everything gets shaken up. So I needed to deal with a lot of past trauma, a lot of past issue. And luckily I went into therapy, but it was... I went into therapy the day after I decided that suicide was the answer. I'm so unbelievably thankful that I did. And I changed my life, because God only knows what I would have left behind with my wife and son if I had taken my own life. But in the darkness of extreme mental illness, suicide unfortunately starts to look like a very viable option.
Do you think that for men, I think... What you're telling me, this story that what you went through is not uncommon for men to bury their grief, for a lot of them to never get to the point that you have gotten to, where they recognize, yes, this is what I'm going through and this is causing this pain. And, you know, I think it's interesting that you talk about like media and distraction, because a lot of men that I have known in my life use, whether it be podcasts or video or music, there's always something on.
Yeah.
And a lot of men I speak to need something to fall asleep. Oh, I have to watch this to fall asleep. I have to listen to this to fall asleep. It's like, oh God, we've moved past the ability to fall asleep without something to, so that your mind, just like you said, your mind doesn't go to the place even for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about that moment where you decided that you needed to go to therapy. Did you get there yourself, or was there someone in your life that said, this has to happen now, you have to take care of yourself and move to that next phase?
Yeah, I mean, when I had the panic attack and stuff, I ignored that. And I was actually closing a deal in my office at the time. So I completely ignored that and that went on for about 40 minutes. And I went back to my hotel, because my office at this stage was in Malta and London. And so I was always living in hotels. I went back to my hotel and just drank some alcohol, which is quite often, you know, the solution. Mm. For people with stress. But I came back that weekend and Beatrice, my wife, said to me, she said, you know, have you noticed that you've stopped petting our dogs? And I found that as really quite a shocking revelation. And I realized that I had. And the more stressed you get, the more anxious you get, the more depressed you get, the narrower the focus is on your life. So you really only have the capacity to do certain things. And every week I had to take a flight. I had to travel for 8 hours to go to an office or to go to a client. I could be going to Sydney or New York or London or wherever. So I was really narrowing the amount of energy I had. So I'd stop giving to my dogs. Now I still, you know, talking to my wife and my son, but that was the moment where I thought, wow, this is different. And then we spoke about therapy. I also spent time with one of my best pals, who's an executive coach, and we had a really good chat. And then I needed to find a therapist, and I wanted to find somebody who was not going to take me down the Medicaid route, because my father had been that way for many years, and he had electric shock treatment and all of that. So I really wanted to find an alternative path. And there was something within me that I didn't quite understand, but I knew I needed a different path. And I found my therapist, who eventually also became my teacher, Dr. Pradeep Chadha, who changed my life. And we had our actually the day I really started to plan my suicide, I'd already spoken to him once, and it was a Sunday morning, and I was sitting in the kitchen. You know, we had everything that people would want. You know, we had money and no stresses and the cars and all that kind of rubbish that we believe is the key to life. But I didn't have myself. I didn't have my own soul. I'd lost connection with that. And I was just planning my suicide, and I texted my therapist, and I said to him, "This is happening." And he said, "Okay." He said, "Do me a favor, just don't do anything between now and tomorrow morning. You will now have an appointment tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, and just be in my office." And it's so weird that connection, but I went, "Oh, okay, I'll be there tomorrow morning." And we then went deep into therapy for the next 3 months. And when I sat with him that next day, he said, "Look, if you do everything I tell you, your life will change, and it'll be completely different." And I did, and it did. And as we finished therapy, I said to him, "Look, I really am amazed at what we've been through, and I would love you to teach me now what you know." And then I became his student, and eventually turned up at a board of investment management and hedge fund business, and told my board and then my shareholders in the investment business that I'm leaving and I'm selling and I'm quitting financial services. And they were all like, "What? What are you going to do?" And I was like, "I'm really got into Buddhist psychology and therapy, and that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life." So that was a really weird place to end up.
That's incredible.
It is sort of quite, you hear from you the positivity and what's come out of a dreadful situation. Do you ever look and think how your life might be different had it not turned out this way?
Yeah, I mean, great question. Quite a lot. I think I would have had some kind of breakdown anyway. You know, I think I'd been living my life in an extreme way since I was 19 years of age. You know, I left Ireland to go to London. I had an incredibly successful career at a very, very young age. I was making an awful lot of money and had huge amounts of responsibility and pressure. I was definitely a workaholic, you know, so I wasn't partying hard. I was working hard. So I think it would have derailed. I look back and I think Joshua came to save me, and that's how I always feel about him. You know, I think he saved me, and he also made me a better father and a better husband. So, you know, I'm so grateful and so thankful for that experience. And like even so it also changed the way that I lived. So, you know, once I could get out of the company and be at home and not travel as much as I did, it was just a game changer for me. But it's funny, like last weekend or the weekend before, my wife and son were away for a couple of days. We have a holiday home down in the south of Ireland, and I had to stay up because I was working. And I was going to bed that night. The house was quiet and our dogs were also with them. And it was so quiet. And I actually took Joshua's urn and I put it up beside my nightstand, and I went to sleep having a chat with him and really just reconnected that moment and just being able to say to him that, you know, thanks for what you did. You know, and I think everybody is a teacher for us in life if we're willing to pay attention. And what that 11-month-old child showed me and taught me was more than anything else I will ever have learned up until that point, and I suspect till the day I die.
Justin, thank you so much for joining us, for sharing Joshua's story with us, and for sharing your really inspiring story. I'm so glad that we got the chance to talk to you today.
Appreciate it so much. Thanks for this resource. I think it's incredible. So thank you very much for what you guys do.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.